It wasn't for going back and forth. At least what we did in the city and being.
How I spent my summer.
Wait, that's what we did.
Praise the Lord.
I spent my summer like every newlywed.
You hadn't listened to it yet, huh? Well, I don't think it'd be any real problem. We're starting another thing on participles today, so everything's kind of pieced together. John?
I didn't make the connection.
Okay. Let me mark it down here. Okay. Okay, continuing review here. We were looking at prepositions yesterday, chapter 25, I believe. And wasn't going to make too many comments on these right now. It's just pretty much vocabulary as far as just learning the prepositions again and reminding those are pretty easy ones to remember. But the key thing here is in section 195, the syntax of prepositional phrases, which is pretty much like English. And we see that Greek prepositional phrases like those of English may be syntactically associated with verbs or with nouns, so you can have what we call adverbial prepositional phrases or adjectival. We were talking about that yesterday. And when a prepositional phrase modifies an articular noun, it may simply follow the noun, just as is pretty common in English. However, Greek prepositional phrases, unlike English prepositional phrases, may have the ordinary attributive positions proper to adjectives. So you'll often see a Greek prepositional phrase in a position very much like an adjective, an attributive position. So a couple of examples, to eis hemas charisma, the gift to us. So the idea to them is the to us gift. That's the kind of gift. It's very adjectival in function, of course. In fact, it's occupying the very same position that adjectives do. And then the next example, to phos, to en soi. Another good example of the idea that actually you're seeing the prepositional phrase take the article here. To is being repeated, and it's functioning just like an adjective would, as if it were in the case and number and so forth of the noun. Of course, it's not, because it is a prepositional phrase, but it's functioning in that position. And then, in addition, you can substantivize a prepositional phrase just like you can an adjective and stick the article on it, and it may have functions of nouns. So we see a number of examples here. Petros kai hoi sunau to, Peter and the ones with him. Hoi sunau to, functioning as a noun here in this context. And hoi ek nomu, those who live by the law, etc. And that's rather common. In fact, you'll find later on that Greek will put an article on just about anything and make it a substantive. Sometimes a whole phrase, a whole clause, a whole sentence even, conceivably could be a substantive for something else. So we'll get to see more of that later on. Okay, the next chapter on prepositions is mainly just dealing with the prepositions that govern two and three cases. And so we see section 197 dia there, governing both the genitive and the accusative. And kata, peri, hyper, hypo, etc., governing two cases. And the basic distinctions have to do with looking at the meaning of the preposition plus the function of the case, and you see kind of a merging of those two meanings. Prepositions governing three cases, same situation there, except now we have a genitive, dative, and accusative cases, all three. Most of these don't occur in equal ratios with all three. Pros, for example, occurs almost always with accusative, and then just a few times with dative, and only one time with genitive in the New Testament. Okay, then a few more remarks here, and some of these remarks have to do with these phonological changes that will occur and certain abbreviations and contractions that take place with prepositions, accent patterns, and so forth. Okay. As I said, we'll be doing a lot more with prepositions this year, so I'm not going to lay a lot of emphasis on it right now. Chapter 27 is the me verbs, and it's kind of a chapter that you wish would go away sometimes. You know, there aren't enough me verbs. There's only a few of them, but their declensions are so different that they constitute a different paradigm, at least for the present imperfect and aorist forms. And that is always kind of a little thorn in the side. You can usually identify the forms, though. Again, like I've said, it's probably not worth your effort to spend all of your time trying to keep this paradigm fully memorized, just because you don't see the forms often enough to really justify that amount of labor. The best thing to do, I think, is just be familiar with the basic pattern and then be able to recognize the forms when you see them. And me verbs are usually not difficult to recognize, especially since vocabulary-wise, these three here that we see are the ones by far the most common. And of course, you've got a me, which is irregular on all counts, and yet quite familiar. So that's, you kind of have to evaluate these things in terms of how frequently they're going to be found, and save your memory load for the things you're going to see all the time. So we won't go into a lot of detail on this, but you see here your paradigms. The irregularities especially are found in the present, imperfect, and aorist form. So you have your present active there, and you've got three sets of verbs here. You've got didomi, tiphemi, and histemi, and these are indicative of the types of patterns that exist. And you find among them a tendency for a variation in thematic vowels as well. You tend to see an O-type sound with didomi, either an omega or omicron. So you see dido me, didos, didosin, didomen, didote, didoasin, or didoasi. With tithemi, you tend to get an eta or an epsilon type of sound. So tithemi, tithes, tithesin, tithemen, tithete, titheasan. And with histemi, you get an eta or an alpha type sound. And alpha seems to be the indicative thematic vowel there. If you look at the plural forms, you'll see that. So it's histemi, histes, histesin, histamen, histate, histasi. So you see some similarities between the three verbs, but the differences are largely of the due to the difference in vowel there. Okay, the imperfect also is irregular. It does have the augment, of course, but as you can see, the forms there: edidun, ediduce, edidu, edidum, and edidote, and edidosan. Excuse me, and the aorist active. Those forms are kind of interesting because to look at them, now we really haven't had perfect forms yet, but to look at them, they look like perfects because they've got that kappa there and then they've got the alpha thematic vowels. And when we look at building perfects later on, you'll see the similarities. So that's one thing you may have to watch for is right after you've gotten into perfects. If you see a me verb that you hadn't seen before and to see it in the aorist, you may confuse it with a perfect, so you have to watch for that. But edoka is your form for didomi, efeka for tithemi, and for histemi you've got two forms, the first aorist and the second aorist. And of course you tell the difference between the two mainly by the ending system. The second aorist has that eta system there. And the first aorist, estesa, you see there. And the second aorist is more of an aorist passive type of form. Even though it's aorist active, it's almost like it's a deponent type of system as well. But the difference, of course, between that has to do with meaning. It has to do with one being a transitive and one an intransitive verb, but we'll get into that a little bit later on. Okay, the present, middle, and passive, those aren't too bad. You've got a stem. You just have to learn the stem and the thematic vowel, and then the endings are pretty similar to what you've seen before. So there is some irregularity here, of course, but omai, you see, and osai, that's a little bit unusual. Otai, that's a little unusual too, but omata, osta, ontai, the same kind of endings you've seen before, except the thematic vowel. And then with tithemi, it's epsilons, and with histemi, it's alphas. Okay, imperfect middle passive and aorist middle forms are seen there too, same kind of irregularities. The future forms and the aorist passive forms of these three verbs are regularly formed, so there's nothing to be worried about on those. It's a matter of just learning a stem again. For the future, doso, for example, doses, and they take the same endings that you've already been familiar with. So the futures and the aorist passive forms are just fine. Okay. The rest of this is just kind of more vocabulary commentary and taking a look at some examples of it, so I won't bother with that. Although section 204 here is that point that we need to make. Histimi is remarkable in having both first aorist and second aorist forms in the active voice. The first aorist active forms, as well as the forms of the present perfect and future active, are used transitively. The second aorist active forms, together with the forms of the future middle and passive and the aorist passive, are used intransitively. So basic distinction is the first aorist forms and the active forms, other active forms, are used transitively. Now, transitively means it can take a direct object. Now, histimi, remember, means to stand. And so if you use it in the transitive forms, the ones that take an object, it means to stand something someplace, or to put or establish or place, that type of an idea, where you're actually performing an action on something else. In the intransitive sense, it's going to mean to stand, stand or stand still or stop or something like this, where you're performing not an action on something else, but you're doing something yourself, and you're not giving it's not taking a direct object. So that's just something to take note of again in terms of meaning. And usually, even before you even look at whether it's first or second aorist or whether it's active or passive form, looking at the context is going to be sufficient to even identify which form you're looking at there. Okay, now the next chapters are really important ones, and we'll have to take some time with these, the participles. There's hardly any particular single area of Greek grammar that's more important than the participle, just because they're used so frequently, much more frequently than in English. And a participle can be described loosely as a verbal adjective. It's functioning in the sentence generally like an adjective, but it's got verbal properties as well. So it's kind of a cross between a verb and an adjective. You know what an adjective is? An adjective is a word that modifies a noun, gives us some more information about the noun and so forth. And what a verb is, expressing action, then you combine those two ideas and you see what a participle is all about. Give some discussion of English participles here. That's probably not even worth looking that much at, because Greek participles, there's some parallels, but the Greek participles seem to be in a class by themselves as far as how frequently they're used. Section 206, though, a Greek verb may have as many as 10 participles. So in English, we're mainly concerned with just a present participle and a past participle, but in Greek, you've got as many as 10 different forms: present, future, aorist, perfect active, and perfect active, present, and perfect middle or passive, and future, and aorist middle, and future, and aorist passive. So we should begin with the present participles. Those are the model verb luo, are set out below. So here we see a paradigm for the participle for luo, which is about as simple as you can come. And notice, if you're looking at the ending systems on these, the masculine form of the participle. Now remember, since the participle is an adjective, it's a verbal adjective, it's going to have a paradigm like an adjective is going to have. In other words, you'll have a paradigm for the masculine forms, for the feminine forms, for the neuter forms. The masculine and neuter paradigms, as you'll see, are a third declension, new tau stem pattern. So remember your nasal stems back there in the new tau stem. This is the same pattern as you saw for those. So luon, luontos, luonti, luonta, luontes, luonton, luusi, and luontas. And then for the neuters, luon, luontos, luonti, luon, etc., luontat, luonton, luusi, and luontat. So these are quite regularly formed according to the patterns that you've seen before. The feminine forms are a little different. You can see that the pattern here is not third declension, but it's first declension. It's like your first declension feminine nouns, and it's in the category of those other kinds, like doxa, that have the alphas in the nominative and accusative and go back to aitas in the genitive and dative. So, and then you also have omicron upsilon morpheme here. You can think of this as an omicron nu tau that's been assimilated or something. It probably doesn't make a whole lot of difference which way you think of it, but that's kind of the way they set up the pattern. Or just a morpheme epsilon sigma, I guess, is the way they set it up here. A morpheme epsilon sigma, and then have that contract with the omicron, and that gives you omicron upsilon. But whether you think of it that way or not isn't all that important. The main thing is just that you know what happens to it. Okay, so there's our paradigm. Now, middle or passive, they're a little bit simpler in some ways. At least because the second declension endings are simpler than the third. If you look at the paradigm there for the middle or passive on the top of page 166, you have luominos, luominu, luomene, luominon, etc. And looking at that, what you find there is adding the base lu, then you added an omicron, then you added a men syllable, me, mu, epsilon, nu, and then adding the second declension type endings for the masculine. Not third declension, but second declension, just like phallus or any of the words that you've seen before in second declension. And the feminines go to first declensions, and they go to the type, the eta type here, and no irregularity there. Eta is all the way through. And then the neuters are just like second declension neuters. So the passive, middle or passive form of the present participle is just like kalos or any other adjective you've seen. Once you've got this morpheme on it and built your stem, your endings are just like kalos. Okay, and the rest of these next two sections are just analyses of that. Next three sections, I guess. Then section 210 deals with contract verbs along the same lines. And again, you can just supply, if you memorize that chart for contractions, so you know which contractions result in what, you can pretty well make it with these as well. So agapa plus omega nu just becomes agapon according to the to contraction rules. Agapa plus ontos is agapontos, etc. So nothing really unusual about these once those contraction rules are applied. And so that holds for agapao, for poyao, for pleroo. They give you whole paradigms for all of these participles, and again, nothing unusual about them. And for the middle and passive participles for these contract verbs, again, since you're adding this men syllable, the contractions are going to be eliminated. You do have to kind of know what's going to happen to the vowel before it. In general, there's going to be a lengthening there. You get an omega for agapomenos, you get omicron upsilon for poyumenos, and pleruminos also omicron upsilon. So you do get a, if you think of just adding omenos to each of those, then the contraction rule would apply there too, and you'd be able to see what takes place. The me verbs, they're also listed here, and they are, as you might expect, a little bit more unusual. In the me verbs, you don't have a stem formative. You just keep that vowel that was there on the me verb in the first place. So for dido me, it's dido plus nu tau plus third declension, number case number suffix. It's tifa plus nu tau or hista plus nu tau. And something else unusual about the me verbs is that the nu tau will assimilate in the nominative singular masculine and the dative plural. It'll assimilate. It'll disappear and cause a vowel change. That doesn't happen with the other verbs. So if you look at the paradigm here at the top of page 170 on didomi, you'll see what happens. It becomes didus, omicron upsilon sigma in the nominative, and then didontos, didonti, etc. In other words, you would have expected maybe didon, omega, nu, but instead you get an assimilation of the nu tau. And then the sigma stays there instead of a C. Before it was the sigma that assimilated. Now it's the nu tau that assimilates. And the same thing happens in your dative plural, deduci, instead of what you might have expected with keeping the nu and so forth. Okay, so that's the unusual feature to note there. Same thing happens with tithemi and histemi. If you look down there at page, section 215, you see tithes, epsilon iota sigma, instead of what you might have expected, tithane or something of that nature. And with histemi, the same thing, histas in the nominative, histasi in the dative plural. Again, the nu tau assimilating. So that's another note to take note of with regard to this. Other than that, though, your endings are pretty straightforward third declension endings. And the differences between the three me verbs are largely the vowel difference again. The O sounds for the didomi, the E sounds for the tithemi, and the A sounds for the histemi. Present, middle, and passive participles of these me verbs do not require special comment. Section 216 here, they are didominos, tithemenos, and histominos. So those are pretty regular. Once you know what that vowel is before the men syllable, then the endings are all straightforward. Present participle of the irregular verb eimi is on, usa, and on for being. The easiest way to remember that is that the paradigm is basically just the endings. You just lop off anything else, and the endings that you had, if you compare the paradigm on the top of page 172, for example, with the paradigm for Luo on the bottom of page 165, you'll see that if you just took a knife, as it were, and cut off the Lu off the previous paradigm, you'd have this one, apart, you know, and then add the accents that are appropriate and the breathing marks. So that's real straightforward. Participles, very nice and regular in the for the verb Amy, whereas the other paradigms for Amy are not. Okay.
Chop off the Lu, that's what you call Lu.
Right, yeah, okay. Well, think of anything you can to remember it. All right. Section 218, deponency or deponent verbs will continue into the participles also. So if it's deponent, like erkomai, the same deponencies will occur into the participle. So, for example, if the verb uses passive forms to give active meaning in the normal paradigm, then the passive participle is going to be used to give your active meaning, and that's what happens with erkomai, for example. The present participle is erkomenos, which is actually a passive form, but it's being given active meaning. Okay, now syntax, the uses of the present participle. There's just a little bit on it here in the end of this chapter, and then the next chapter is going to deal in more detail with the differences between what we call attributive and circumstantial participles. But here he gives just a basic presentation here. First of all, since participles function like adjectives, then present participles now are going to be placed in positions common to adjectives. First, they'll be used with anarthrous nouns, and apophneiskontes anthropoi, here's an example of an anarthrous noun, anthropoi, and then apophneiskontes, present participle, talking about dying men or mortal men, dying men. So it's just an adjective like anything else, although the adjective is describing a verbal action, in this case the verbal action of dying. And then you have another example of sounding gong, clanging cymbal, same situation. Those are with anarthrous nouns. And with an anarthrous noun, you could have the participle either before or after the noun, just like kalos or any other adjective can be before or after the noun with an anarthrous noun, and it's not going to make any difference as far as the position and the meaning is concerned. Maybe slight difference in emphasis is all. Then with articular nouns, you can find a participle in either of the two attributive positions, either the first attributive position or the second attributive position. Can you guess why they don't say anything about predicate positions here for participles? Do you remember? Yes. No, what will happen is in the next section here, what happens with a participle is that they'll use the form of the verb to be when they want to express that kind of thing. And actually, the result of that is a more of a progressive aspect. And what we normally associate with a predicate position, though, we'll see about in the next chapter. What happens there is we have what we call a circumstantial participle. And when you don't use the article on the participle and you had it on the noun, we have a circumstantial participle. So that position doesn't really exist anymore. It's the thing that used to be that position is now serving a different function. So that's the thing to note about these. So this point number two here, with articular nouns, it can be in the first attributive position and or the second attributive position, and I think you're pretty familiar with those positions. But section 220 talks about present participles may also, like adjectives, be used predicatively when they are so used. However, some form of the verb ame or some other equative verb is always expressed. So they'll always use a form of ame or another equative verb when they're going to use a participle in a predicate type of situation. The resulting periphrastic construction is exactly parallel to the English present progressive, past progressive, and future progressive tenses. And, of course, that whether it's present, past, or future depends on the form of the verb ame that's associated with it, not on the participle. The participle will always be present because it's trying to show this progressive aspect. And so here you see some examples. Hey, diakonia estin perisousa. The ministry is abounding. So we have estin there. We have a form of the verb to be with the participle. And it's indicating a progressive action, and it's a way to really clearly and powerfully express progressive aspect. If you want an unambiguous way to show progression, and in the present especially, this would be used. And here another example, Mark 2:18, Eison hoi mathe tai iwan nukai hoi pharisai oi nestuontes. Eison nestuontes. You see, there's your verb pattern. Verb form ami, and then a present participle. Now, the verb form in this case is imperfect, so it's saying they were, past tense, fasting, but it was progressive. What the action is progressive. Okay, so in other words, instead of using what we normally associate with a predicate position, just putting the participle, say, next to the noun without the article, they are going to use the form of the verb to be here. And the reason, you know, I don't know if this is the reason they did it, but at least in your mind, to keep a distinction, if you use what we normally associate it as a predicate position with a participle, you're going to get a circumstantial participle meaning out of it, and that's what's going to come up in the next chapter. So this is perhaps one of the reasons why they're using the verb to be all the time to make it real clear, because they kind of relinquish that other function to some other purpose. This use of the present participle is much rarer in Greek than it is in English. The periphrastic construction usually emphasizes the duration of the action, although frequently it does not seem to differ significantly from the simple verb. Those kinds of statements, I think, take with a grain of salt. I am always inclined to say there is a difference if a certain construction is used when the other could be used. In English, we may not make a big difference in translation, but I think we need to pay attention to the fact that something is in a progressive, real emphatic progressive construction like this rather than the simple verb form. So always take note of those at least. Okay, then the present participles may be used substantively just like everything else. We saw prepositional phrases used that way, we saw adjectives used that way, and so here we see participles used that way, and that's also quite frequent. Romans 12:7, just one example, ho didaskon, the teaching one. So they're taking the participle for teaching in the nominative masculine singular form and putting the article on it is now making it into a noun, and it's a noun that's describing somebody who's doing a certain thing. In fact, a lot of nouns actually are derived from participles this way, especially agency type nouns and this type of thing. So ho didaskon, it becomes almost in effect, it's functioning clearly like a noun. Okay, he also makes a remark here, the anarthrous participle may be used substantively. So even without the article, you may see a participle being used as a substantive. Without the article, it's a little harder to identify that use, but context will usually suffice. So he gives an example, Romans 8:38 here, the melonta, things to come. And the way it's set up in the context and so forth indicates that it's a substantive use of the participle. Those, I think, are pretty straightforward and easy to identify. Then there's one more point that needs to be made in section 222 about participles, and that has to do with the verbal function of the participle. Now, participle is kind of a crossbreed, as it were. It's like an adjective, and it's got endings like adjectives and so forth, but it's also verbal, and it's got verbal properties to it. And we know that verbs can take objects, direct objects and indirect objects and so forth, and that's also true of participles. So the participle may take objects and other things and become a whole participial phrase, and that whole phrase now will be modifying the noun in question. So as we noted in passing, the beginning of this lesson, participles are verbal adjectives. In addition to the characteristics which they share with adjectives, they also have characteristics in common with verbs. In particular, they govern objects and have other adjuncts proper to verbs. So looking at a few examples here, and these things happen very frequently. I think it's more rare to run across a Greek sentence in the New Testament that doesn't have a participle than one that does. I mean, it seems like they're using them all the time. And these participial phrases are very common. So, hoi oikousa enemoi hamartia, the sin dwelling in me. Now, if we were to diagram this, and we will a little bit later on, we'll learn how to diagram Greek sentences, we would have this whole phrase, oikousa enemoi. That whole thing is in a attributive position. You see, you have the hey, you have the article, and then you have that whole phrase, and then your noun, hamartia. So literally, it's the in me dwelling sin. It's the dwelling in me sin, and that's the way that your mind picks it up when you read the Greek phrase. After a while, when you get used to thinking in this Greek mode of expression, it's very, very logical, very, very nice way to express things. And so, hey, oikousa enemoi hamartia. And you see now we have enemoi is a prepositional, an adverbial prepositional phrase modifying the verbal idea of the dwelling. The dwelling where? The dwelling in me. See? And that would be considered adverbial. And then the whole phrase, oikousa en emoi, would be considered in an adjectival position, attributive position, relative to he hamartia. Okay, the other examples are similar to that. All right, any questions about this chapter on participles, as far as the forms of them and the basic syntax? Main things to remember are the fact that the participle is a verbal adjective, so it's going to function like an adjective, and it's going to function also like a verb, and that the paradigms for the forms of the present participle, at least, which we're dealing with in this chapter, the active ones follow pretty much the third declension forms in the masculine and neuter, and second declension ones like, or first declension ones like doxa in the feminines, and then the passive ones have certain morphemes attached to them. Men is something that your eye picks up right away. That's how you identify those things when you see them, and then your normal adjective endings like kalos. Okay, the next chapter deals with the distinction. Yes,
yeah, I just
Greg?
I wanted to verify that there is no imperfect or imperfect
participle. Right. Yeah, there's no imperfect ones at all, and there will be perfect participles. There won't be any pluperfect. And what was the other one you mentioned? Huh?
Future
perfect? No, no need to worry about those either. So there are plenty to worry about as it is. Okay, and a lot of those may, some of them even future participles. Period. Just an ordinary future active participle is relatively rare. There's enough of them to take, we have to learn the paradigm how to make them, but they're not used very frequently. Majority of the participles you'll see will be present participles or aorist participles. Those are the most common ones. And so, of course, they'll be active and passive. I've never done an analysis of it to see which is most frequent, but I would guess that you're going to see the number one would be a present active participle. That would be your most common one, and number two maybe an aorist active, and then the passive ones that come in below that someplace. Yes, Steve?
I had a note here that parts of your phrase stay together, but that's all the elements of a participle.
Yes, right. Yeah, you can't. See, you can't take a participial phrase and take the stuff that's attached to the participial phrase and stick it out over here and have other words that are a part of the main body of the sentence in between. Because if you do that, you'll lose the structure. So there are some word order considerations here. When you see a participial phrase, the stuff that's part of the participial phrase will be run together. Now, it may vary in its own word order structure within that phrase, but it's not going to be intermixed with words from the rest of from the main body of the sentence. Because if you do that, then you're going to lose the continuity and the understanding of how these things fit together. So that's a good observation to make. Generally, a participial phrase won't have a lot of stuff on it, but it's conceivable to have a participial phrase in which the participle has a direct object, has an indirect object. Maybe even if it were a certain type of verb, you could have two accusatives, some certain types of verbs or an object complement. And it can also have several prepositional phrases and prepositional phrases modifying and adjectives modifying each, the object and the direct object and so forth. So it could get conceivably very long. But if it will, you'll find usually it will be set off in the text by commas. And then the whole participial phrase will be together, another comma, and then you'll be resuming the main structure of the sentence. But you won't see the participial phrase mixed together with the other, because then you would lose the continuity. So there are some word order considerations, of course, in Greek. There has to be some. Okay. Now, present participles, the next chapter on this, chapter 29, is, as I said, dealing with this distinction between what we call an attributive participle and a circumstantial participle. And it's a little bit hard to say in a few simple words what the difference between those is. So a lot of attention has been given here to showing you examples of the two. And in English, often the only difference will be intonation patterns, commas, setting things off. Although sometimes we can go ahead and put extra words in there that will make the distinction too. But he gives you two sentence examples here. The apostle baptizing the disciples glorifies God. And then the second example, the apostle, comma, baptizing the disciples, comma, glorifies God. In the first example, the phrase baptizing the disciples is modifying apostle. The apostle baptizing the disciples glorifies God. So we're trying to say the apostle who is, you might even supply the who is there, the apostle who is baptizing the disciples glorifies God. And so you're using the phrase baptizing the disciples to describe the apostle and to designate which apostle you're talking about. Whereas in the second example, the apostle, comma, baptizing the disciples, comma, glorifies God. would be modifying the verbal idea of glorifies, and it's showing you how he's glorifying God. He's glorifying God by baptizing the disciples. In fact, that might be rendered a little bit less ambiguously in English by saying the apostle, while baptizing the disciples, glorifies God, or as he baptized the disciples, or by baptizing the disciples, something of that nature. And this is something maybe to take note of when it comes, since we're going to be doing it this direction primarily. We're going to be going from Greek to English. And so we are going to be seeing participles in either attributive positions or circumstantial positions in the Greek, and we're going to want to translate that into English. And I would highly recommend that when you translate these participial phrases into English, you use phrases like who is or while or something like this to make a clear, unambiguous distinction between the use of the circumstantial and the attributive position. Because just to do it with commas like this still leaves enough ambiguity, I think, to, you know, generate a certain amount of confusion. I think it's better just to translate in such a way that there's no question. Because the Greek does give you that information. It is transmitting information about the distinction between these types of participles, and I think it would be important for us to make note of that. All right. He goes on now to talk about what Greek is going to do to illustrate the same distinctions. At the top of page 176, we see these same two sentences. The first one, ho apostolos ho baptizon tus mathetas doxaze ton theon. Now we see ho apostolos ho baptizon tus mathetas. We see the repetition of the article after apostolos, and we see that, therefore, in effect, an article on the participle, and that is going to mean that this is an attributive participle, and it's functioning just like an adjective in an attributive position. And so we can see that that whole baptizon there is telling us it's the apostle who is baptizing the disciples glorifies God. Yes?
Would it be right to say, or one way of thinking of it would be the apostle, the one baptizing the disciples glorifies God?
Yes, that's a good way to do it. In fact, that's even closer to the two literal rendering. The apostle, the one baptizing the disciples. You see, that's it's telling you something about it. It's first... introduces the apostle, and then by repeating the article, it's telling you some more information about that apostle, the one baptizing the disciples. That's a good way to think of it. I think that'll steer you right every time. Now, on the other hand, the next sentence, the apostle baptizing the disciples glorifies God, is rendered in Greek by ho apostolos baptizon tus mathetas doxaze ton theon. Identical sentence except for the absence of the article on the participle. And that's a significant absence. You see, that makes the participle, if you think of it, of the positions you saw before, it makes the participle occupy what we used to call a predicate position. Now that you see there's no repetition of the article, and now this thing is following. But it doesn't get the meaning that we usually associate with predicate position. That's taken care of by using the form of the verb to be with participles. So this is giving us a different meaning, and this is a meaning we call the circumstantial participle. Circumstantial participle you can think of as describing the circumstances under which the action takes place, and therefore it's very adverbial. In other words, it's more modifying the verbal idea. In this case, doxadze, glorifies, is telling you the apostle, while baptizing the disciples, or as he baptizes the disciples, something of that nature, glorifies God. Now, the exact phraseology may also depend on the context, exactly the way you want to render that. But the essential idea is that this participial phrase is adverbial. Yes, Glenn?
I was wondering about word order here, how essential it was. Figured you couldn't put, if you put baptizon tus mathetas out on the end, that would come down. But what if you put ho apostolos ton theon, doxaze, baptizon tus mathetas? I mean, you just mix it up, but you're trying
to... Oh, I see. Ho apostolos.
From baptizon.
Yeah.
Away with that.
I doubt that you would. You see, if you get into a situation, if you put ho apostolos ton theon, baptizon tus mathetas, you probably could get away with it just because baptizon obviously has to refer back to ho apostolos. It wouldn't refer to ton theon because of the cases. You're probably not going to see that very frequently. It's just they like to put that participle pretty close to what it's modifying. It doesn't really have to be, but you need to keep those things in the participial phrase together. Now, that would still keep them together. Ton theon would be a part of the participial phrase, but you're opening the door to some potential confusion, especially, for example, if you have a neuter noun involved where you can't tell between the accusative and the nominative. You can get a real big can of worms there. So if you have ambiguities, you'll probably not see that. And I think we just have to watch and see if it ever happens that way. But in just trying to think of it, I it seems to me that almost always you're going to see the participial phrases pretty much locked together with a participle first and following the noun that it's modifying. But we'll just have to watch and see. There isn't much said here in the textbook about various arrangements of order on that. Huh? No, I don't think so. I don't think you can say that. There isn't a hard and fast rule that says this participle must, you know, be first. There isn't any such rule. But I think it just is a matter of trying to eliminate ambiguities. And there's certain a natural way you're going to speak, and that it may not even be a conscious thing.
Well, it seems to me that really when you talk about words in a truly predicate position, it's really just because whether you have the article on it.
Right.
And if
yeah.
you have the article, it seems to me you can bust up the predicate
yeah.
position and not have to worry
about yeah, it. Yeah, that's really more accurate. I'm just drawing an analogy to a predicate position in this position, but in this example, but it's not, don't even really think of it as a predicate position. The major criterion is presence of the article versus lack of the article in the participle. That's the thing to watch. So if the article's got if the participle has the article, it's going to be an attributive participle. If the participle doesn't have the article, it's going to be a circumstantial participle, and don't even think of it necessarily as a predicate position. That's the criteria that's established here, and so that will loosen up the restrictions as far as word order is concerned on a predicate position. But like I said, we'll just have to watch here and see if we see anything else. But it may never occur, or may only rarely occur, that you see the word order change within the participial phrase. Okay, but that's the essential distinction, is the presence of the article versus the lack of the article. Okay.
Mike?
Yes.
I think when you mentioned that whenever it's going to be in a circumstantial situation, then it will always be adverbial.
Right. It'll be.
That's the difference, though. One is the
yeah.
title, one's always adverbial.
Right. Exactly. That's your major functional difference between the two. The attributive is telling you something more about a noun that has just been introduced, so it's going to be an adjectival function. And the circumstantial is going to be somehow dealing with the action performed, the verbal action, and something qualifying something happening at the same time or as this is happening or something of that nature. And you'll see that consistently as you go through. Of course, he develops a whole series of examples on this issue of baptizing the disciples, first attributive and then circumstantial here. And as you look at these examples, the only difference between the two on corresponding ones is the lack of the article on the circumstantial ones. And so if you look at number A over here under attributive, ho baptizon tous mathetas doxaze ton theon, he who is baptizing the disciples glorifies God. Whereas over there in A under the circumstantial, baptizon tous mathetas doxaze ton theon, while baptizing the disciples he glorifies God. Or as he baptizes the disciples he glorifies God, something of that nature. Again, now without the article, that whole phrase is really modifying the idea of glorifies. See, he glorifies God is your main sentence structure, and then if you were to put this in a diagram, you would put while baptizing the disciples, that would go under the verb. It would go under glorifies. It would not go under he. Whereas in the first one, it would go under he. And when we do diagramming, this will be a real graphic difference. When you're diagramming, if you've got a circumstantial participle, you're going to attach it to the verb. If you've got an attributive participle, you'll attach it to the noun, wherever that happens to be in the sentence. Now, an attributive participle doesn't have to be attached only to the subject. It may be the direct object, maybe the indirect object, maybe the object of preposition, maybe any number of things. And circumstantial participle may not even be attached to the main verb. It may be attached to another participle. It may be attached to an infinitive or some other type of verbal idea, but it will be adverbial. It will be modifying some verbal idea of some sort. Okay. So that major distinction, I think, is pretty straightforward. It's very common, and you'll see enough of it to have to watch for this real carefully. Section 226 deals with another use of participles. It should be noted that an attributive participial expression is usually best rendered in English by a relative clause, and we'll get into actual relative clauses later on, but a relative clause in English is a clause introduced by who, which, or that. In other words, the participle, since it's attributive and since it's got a verbal function to it, is almost acting very much like a relative clause in English, where we, you know, the man who baptizes the disciples. And in English, that is a relative clause. In Greek, they're doing it with a participle. And that a circumstantial expression is usually best translated by a clause introduced by as, while, when, because, etc., depending on the context. And those are all adverbial type of, conjunctions or particles and so forth, depending on how you analyze them. With certain verbs, however, it is possible to render the Greek participle directly by an English participle and to understand it as supplementing the main verb. In the latter case, the participle agrees with the subject or object, depending on which it has reference to. So what we'll find here, then, is generally a finite verb form and then a participle used in addition to that that's almost completing the idea of the verb. For example, it says, "Epausa to lalon," he stopped speaking. Okay? The idea here is not just that he stopped, but he stopped speaking. And so you've got two verbal ideas here, and the speaking part is illustrated in the Greek by a participle. So he stopped speaking. It's kind of a complementary participle, or something that's complementing the action of the main verb. They will see the Son of Man coming. They will see what? They'll see the Son of Man, and they'll see an action. They'll see a coming. They'll see some verbal action taking place. And so that's translated in English even by a participle. This last usage is not unusual, but is not met with frequently in the New Testament. The verbs with which it occurs are those in the example cited and a few others. There are certain kinds of verbs, you see, that have this kind of thing happen. And so you've got huparko, which means to be or exist. You've got teleo, which means to finish. You know, you can finish doing something. You can stop. The dialepo means to stop. Kalos means to do. And kalos poieo, excuse me, that goes together, to do well. And you could do something well, and some verbal action well. Akuo, you can hear something, or blepo, see something, and that's verbal action. Gnosko, to know. Theoreo means to observe, and heurisko means to find. So, you can find someone sleeping or something like that. In other words, that's the kind of an idea. These verbs are all such that they can take a participial modifier, as it were, in a certain sense. It's really an adverbial construction, just like a circumstantial participle would be. And, of course, these don't have the article, so they're going to be analyzed as circumstantial also. Okay, then, section 227. It's very important to understand that the present participle does not necessarily refer to present time. We already touched on that a little bit when we saw it used with these auxiliary verbs and getting that progressive aspect. That progressive aspect might have been past, present, or future, depending on the auxiliary verb that was attached to it, the form of the verb to be. And so you can suspect that may be the case. Indeed, it has no tense of its own at all, properly speaking, but only aspect. It usually refers to an action in progress at the same time as the action of the main verb. Now, this is the distinction that we want to make with participles in general. We'll talk about aorist and future participles in a little bit. But the idea of a participle is that the present participle is that the action is going on at the same time as the action of the main verb. So you can think of the tense of the participle as somewhat a slave to the tense of the main verb. If it's a present participle, it will be the same as the action of the main verb. Now, the main verb may be past, present, or future. And you'll use a present participle if you want to indicate that the action of the participle is going on at the same time as the action of the main verb. And so it's kind of a relative tense idea. The present tense still means something, though. The fact that it's a present participle means that from the standpoint of if you are transferring yourself into the time realm of the main verb of the sentence, then being in that time realm, the participial action is present to you. See, if you think of it that way, I think it may help. But the idea of the present is something going on at the same time as the action of the main verb. So if the main verb is past, it will be translated in such a way that it's a past participle. It's something that is going on in the past, but in a progressive aspect, and at the same time as the action in the past. So if you're in the past, it's a present participle to you. That's the idea. So here's some examples. Romans 14:2, ho asthenon lachana esthia, he who is weak eats vegetables. Okay, the weak one, he who is weak. And it's present participle, and it's a present verb form, eats. So the participial action is at the same time as the action of the main verb. He who is weak eats vegetables. Okay, then associated with the main verb in the past tense, Huron en to hiero tus pleruntas boas. He found in the temple those who were selling oxen. Okay, he found in the temple. That's an aorist verb form, so it's past tense. And then the participle, though, is present. And so he found in the temple those, but we're translating those who were selling oxen, because we are looking at it from the standpoint of right now, and the whole thing took place in the past. And even though it's a present participle, it's referring to something that took place in the past, because the main verb was past. However, though, you can see here that if you transfer yourself back to the time that the finding took place, you'll find that he found those who were, who are selling oxen at the time he's finding. In other words, from his time frame, they're selling oxen, and he finds them at the time that they're doing that. So it is a present participle from the standpoint of the action of the main verb. Relative to the main verb, it's present. And so the present form is used in Greek. Whereas in English, we would translate it as a past. And then associated with the main verb in the future tense, hemes hoi zontes harpage somatha en nephelis, we who are alive, or who shall be living at the time, shall be snatched up in the clouds. And here's the idea, we who are alive at that time shall be caught up to meet him in the air. And again, the same picture is seen there. The participial idea of being caught up and so forth, or excuse me, being alive, hoizontes, present participle, is present with relative to the action of the main verb, which doesn't, you know, see, this is important because this doesn't mean that Paul is necessarily saying that he was going to live till the time of the rapture. It just means that the ones living at that time, and of course he called himself we, we find that it doesn't necessarily imply that he expects and is certain that he's going to be alive at that time. But if he is, he'd be part of the we too. And we who are alive, or who will be living at that time, will be snatched up in the clouds. Yes? Is that the point you want to make? Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, there's no fault here. He's obviously identifying with that group, and since he doesn't know when that time's going to come, and from his perspective for sure, then he might as well say that. I mean, we talk that way too, and it's possible that some of us may go home to be with the Lord before the rapture occurs, but that's not going to change the way we talk. And also, of course, the Apostle Paul later on in 1 Timothy and other places, he talks about fighting the good fight of faith and having a crown laid up for him, and he talks as though he expects to be going home to be with the Lord before these events occur. Yes, Tony?
He also, I've noticed in reading, he also tends to use these pronouns of him, not so much, I don't think he's talking about himself, but as a category of Christians.
Sure,
versus
sure.
The category of the world, they.
Yeah, we versus they, yeah.
Right. He doesn't have to refer to himself at all, since it's a class.
Sure.
He was speaking better of the rest
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's personally, you know, identifying with everything that's going on, but like you say, when you're talking theology, and you're making a theological distinction between the people in the world and those that are the saints of God and so forth, it's very appropriate as well. But here you can see then that a present participle is simply denoting action at the same time as action of the main verb. Now later on we're going to talk about aorist participles and future participles. And almost all the textbooks say this about present participles, and they say the future participles are always action future to the action of the main verb. But aorist participles, they've always got some controversy about. And we'll look at it in the book. He treats it kind of interestingly. He says there's a few exceptions. The bottom line is that action antecedent to the action of the main verb is what you use an aorist participle for. Although a lot of books will say it's antecedent to, simultaneous with, or future. You know, they just throw it all together and say it doesn't really make any difference. And a lot of the reason for that is certain kinds of theological implications. And when the real truth is really known, that's what the problem really is. Okay, we're out of time here today, but tomorrow we'll make a few more comments about this genitive absolute, another participial phrase that's important, and then talk about future and aorist participles. It won't take too long to go through that. Next major area, I think, is the infinitives, and then the rest is odds and ends, and that'll bring us right up to where we are. So we'll hope we'll make it quite that far tomorrow, and now we'll see how far we get. I'm not too worried about how much time it's taking, because this time is time well spent. And if we don't do it, we'll just have to do it later anyway, because we'll forget and say, well, what about that, you know? Okay, thank you.
I'm not going to recall any time doing a study on the Matthew. Mark 15:18.